I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Mark Burry joins me again. His latest book, Ripper, The Making of Pierre Poilievre, was recently published to good reviews, and it's already on the bestseller list. As I admit to Mark in the interview that we taped on Friday morning, I've never found Poilievre an interesting person because he has always seemed to be a glib fighter, prone to theatrics and quips rather than ideals and policy. Yet I have found Mark's book highly readable, an indispensable chronicle of Canadian political culture in the last 20 to 25 years, as well as an indictment of the qualities that Poilievre has that make him less than ideal to become Prime Minister of Canada, which he could very well be in a week's time. The title of the book comes from David Brooks, who said that there are two types of politicians, rippers and weavers. Rippers, whether they're of the left or the right, see politics as war. They'll seek power and destroy whatever is in their way for it. And the portrait of Poilievre is that he's got little practical experience outside of politics, seemingly angry all the time, and somebody who sees little value in consensus. Poilievre is seemingly the right and wrong person for the moment. He evokes in his supporters victimhood in a country that they'll claim is broken. They're tired with the Liberal decade in power because it frustrates them that they're not in power. Poilievre has never changed. The country has. That's why so many people in this country will vote for him. At the same time, as the book points out, he's wrong for this moment because of the existential crisis that the country finds itself in, what with Donald Trump and his various pronouncements. It might be said that had Trump not come to power again, Poilievre might have better poll numbers. And as Burry warns, he might not be the best sort of leader to deal with Trump because the evidence through his political record suggests he'll just knuckle under to get along. Mark Burry is an Ottawa-based author, lawyer, and journalist. He holds a master's in journalism from Carleton and a PhD in history from the University of Ottawa. His Juris Doctor degree was awarded in 2017, and he was called to the bar in 2018. He's won numerous awards for his journalism, including a National Magazine Award, as well as the RBC Charles Taylor Prize in 2020 for his book Bushrunner, The Adventures of Pierre Esprit Radisson. He's appeared on the program with that book, as well as last year's bestseller, Crosses in the Sky, Jean de Brebeuf and the Destruction of Huronia. This new book is published by Biblioasis. Please welcome back to the Plante on the Line program, Mark Burry. Dr. Burry, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Near the back of the book, you chronicle the change in Canadian media and how outlets like True North or Post-Millennial have emerged. We're speaking the morning after the English language debate where Ezra Levant and Rebel Media caused a bit of a scene there in Montreal after the debate, even before the debate. What do you make of how the media has changed and the emergence of outlets like this? I mean, COIN in the ad issue panel last night said, let this be sort of the end of the idea that these outlets are manned by journalists, say. Did you think people will see it like that?
I don't know, because I don't think they see enough behind the scenes of what's going on.
Yeah.
That is possible, but they deliberately make this look like media. Mm-hmm. They deliberately make themselves look like reporters, and their podcasts and their broadcasts look like the real thing. So whether people can sort that out and understand that it's not really what it seems to be is a different thing.
Yeah, I have to say, in reading the book in the last few days, rereading it, I should say, amidst the backdrop of this election campaign, it's fascinating to see how this infrastructure has come about and how it's propelled Poilievre to where he's gotten, say.
Yeah, I wrote about it in the book that I had that came out in early 2015, where I could see this coming, this idea of creating a sort of a parallel media universe, and that is almost always conservative. It's something that was going on in the States already and was spreading into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
This is before Rebel News. It was still the time of the Sun News Network. But there were other sort of smaller fish out there in terms of this kind of like pseudo media. And I thought it was very, very dangerous. And you know, it's not paranoia to say this is part of that movement of Trump and Orban and, mm-hmm. and Wathers and Farage and folks like that. And just as I was finishing the book, Viktor Orban actually said, was quoted saying, we need to make our own media. And that's exactly what they're doing.
The other thing as I was reading the book is I noticed how quickly it's all come together. When did you decide that Polyev was going to be the subject of a book, say?
Around the end of May, beginning of June last year. Mm. So it was a pretty fast book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you refer to things, you know, in January even. Right. In the book. It was just fascinating to read over the last few weeks how it's come together and how thorough it also is. I mean, you know, the chronicle of, say, his career, it's quite thorough. And I guess you were still covering the Hill at the time, right? When he first was elected, right?
Oh, yeah. I was there till 2018. So, I talked to him years before. Mm-hmm. When he was working for Ezra Levant. Now, that's something people don't remember is that he actually worked for Levant before he got himself elected. He worked for Levant in Calgary when Levant was going for a nomination, and I talked to him, you know, phone conversation back then. It was like year 2000 or so. So yeah, I've seen him up close for a very long time, and it's only recently that I took him seriously. I saw him as sort of a sort of B-team player who was brought up once in a while to, you know, for his nastiness and then sort of put back on the shelf.
Yeah, the way he comes across in political life, for those of us who view politics, say, you know, he comes across as an unlikable guy. Yet as we read about him in your book, you illustrate him in such a way that it makes him interesting, but you also use characters like Blofeld from the James Bond series and that creep from Dirty Dancing to sort of, I guess, illustrate just how a lot of people view him.
Yeah.
When you talk to him up close, though, when it's one-to-one, say, one-on-one, does he seem like that in person?
No, but I figure any politician who can't hold a conversation with someone for 20 minutes without being weird, you know, she really shouldn't be in that line of work. but you know, I've talked to him, and he seemed okay to me. And other people I've talked to, and I quote one guy in the book, but not by name because everybody's afraid to have their name in it.
Yeah.
But saying that when this is one-on-one, he's fine. But when somebody else pops up, then sort of the show starts. I can't imagine anybody can keep up that level of sort of anger energy 24/7 and you know, be able to sleep at night and things like that. So, you know, but I'm really not privy to his personal life by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. So if he is that the you know, the showman that he is, and you know, we as we read the book, you know, he can get very angry and he's quick with slogans and catchphrases. It's sort of, it's indicative of where the country's turned to, I guess, right? I mean, the country has turned to a guy like him.
Well, yeah, I think we still haven't recovered from COVID. I think that a lot of us, I know I can speak for myself, but I still feel like my life is disrupted, that things never got back to normal, and things never got normal. I have adult children. Things never got normal for them either, and I know that they paid a pretty heavy price for, you know, from the disruption that was caused by COVID. So I do understand where people are coming from when they are angry about change. I don't think there's much anybody could have done about it, though. Unlike, say, the convoy crowd who believe this was, you know, that COVID itself was a non-disease and that got the government overreach. I think that anybody who has any sort of sense of responsibility pretty much had to do what governments had to do. But yeah, so I think that a lot of people are struggling, and he has a very good antenna for picking up on that sort of thing. And then just basically offering these easy answers to problems that a lot of us are having a hard time picking.
So if he's playing to that irrational crowd that we increasingly saw over the last 4 or 5 years, you know, how sustainable is that if he becomes prime minister at the end of the month?
Well, yeah, I mean, if he becomes prime minister, I'm sure there'll be a few years where he just blame everything on other liberals and say it's unfixable, blame anything on the Senate that you can't get through if he doesn't a minority, and if he's got a minority, then blame the other parties for not supporting his legislative agenda. So there'll be lots of opportunities to blame others for his policies not working, but eventually, at some point, people will realize that, like Trump's policies, what he's offering just doesn't work, and there'll be some buyer's remorse.
There's a character in the book that you talk about that I found interesting, and that's Jenny Byrne. Her role in his life and career. I guess she's got a major role in this campaign, running the campaign, right?
Oh, yeah. She's at the top of the campaign.
Yeah.
The knives are already out for her.
Indeed. We saw that in recent weeks. So they were in a relationship at one point, and they still work together as they do. There's similarities. I mean, I found that fascinating. I mean, their temperament, I guess, even if we just took that for one, they do share a sort of temperament that I guess a lot of people find off-putting, don't they?
Yeah, they don't listen to people. They don't. They're not looking for feedback or discussion or debate. They are completely convinced that their worldview is accurate, and that anybody who doesn't share it is simply wrong, and usually wrong because they're corrupt or compromised or brainwashed by the World Economic Forum or some such thing. And that this is a big problem in the campaign, is that they're not even listening to other members of their own party and doing it their way. And you know, the Ontario Conservatives, Corey Chenecki, who ran Doug Ford's campaign, are blaming her for running this campaign into the ground, for basically losing one that they could have won.
Well, what do you think that says about people who spend too much time in politics, who have little experience, say, outside of politics?
Yeah, you know, I think they should. I think, the same goes for journalists, frankly, that you have to know the world before you can govern it or report on it. Which really should involve some time, say, you know, traveling or working in the private sector, working in crappy jobs, or you know, the kind of jobs where you know, have to work midnights and have to wear steel-toed boots and all that kind of stuff, right? Or service jobs, you know, say in a snotty neighborhood working for a Starbucks, we have to deal with the public just to understand like the reality of people's lives, because for a lot of these people, you know, who are in media political bubble, the world of the rest of us is abstract, and they're often quite inaccurate. The views become rather patronizing. People like Polyev and Byrne, and you know, and Andrew Coyne and folks like that too, who've always lived a life separate from the mass of the rest of us.
In your research, in writing Ripper, do you find out anything about Polyev and say any interests outside of politics? I mean, is he interested in sport or sailing even?
No, not anymore. He was really sporty as a kid, and then he got the political bug. But no, I've never seen any sign of him having any interest in anything other than politics. And even when he, you know, shows some sort of interest, it's always very public. You know, apparently there's a video of him with jet skis or something, which is not exactly like rocket science to learn how to run one. As we see on our lakes and rivers, any idiot can do it. But even then, there's a camera present. Right? So I don't think there's anything for him other than politics, which makes this such an existential crisis for him. to have this leadership, to be this close to power, and if he doesn't win, what happens to him? It would be rather scary to be in his situation right now. This is a person, a human being.
Yeah. There's a fact in the book that I found interesting. I was curious to know how you found out about it. He's a bit of a coffee snob, is he?
Yeah. I've heard that from quite a few people. And you can be in Ottawa somewhat. I mean, as much as Ottawa has anything any good, it's got like a lot of decent coffee shops. so wow, eh? More reason to come to Ottawa from Vancouver in the winter.
Yeah.
Which has just ended here finally, I think. So yeah, no, that's one thing about him is he's a bit of a coffee snob. But again, that does not require a lot of work or time investment.
You warn us in the book about the worst of, say, U.S. style dirty politics becoming normalized in Canada. And you know, I was thinking, you know, if he does become prime minister, which, you know, was a possibility, a very close possibility, you know, several weeks ago, and it's still very be, right? You know, some people grow into that role of, you know, once they're in that office. I mean, could he change, say, once he becomes prime minister, or do you think, knowing him as well as you do, that there's no hope in that?
I don't think so. I don't think he can change, because I think what he is what he's been for so long. Plus, there's that lack of experience in the world. Like, I could only find one time when he traveled. Even when he was in government, he didn't have to travel for any of the jobs that he had in Harper's ministry. Yeah. I mean, not outside of Canada. So he hasn't seen much, he hasn't done much. He hasn't been challenged much. And these kind of people, as we see with Trump, they tend to surround themselves with yes men and women. And so things can get really bad. A person can grow into a job if they realize that they weren't right about something and are open to looking at other solutions, and don't see this as a big personal loss, some sort of loss of faith if they decide that, you know, maybe locking people up for the rest of their natural life doesn't work. And, you know, someone actually shows them stats from the States where if they do that,
The other part in the book where you talk about, say, his part in the We Charity situation, the election skullduggery during the Harper years, you know, with in and out and robocalls, I mean, that's enough to be disqualifying it. I don't think that's a part of his career. I mean, I guess that's how we got to know him a great deal.
Yeah.
But at the same time, not too many people think that that's disqualifying, say.
Well, you know, what used to be disqualifying in politics has become normalized under Trump. I mean, the idea of a convicted felon being president of the United States, a person who's been found to be a rapist is mm-hmm. president of the United States. The idea that people can be grabbed off the street and shipped off to a gulag in El Salvador without trial, and then which is appalling enough, and then it turns out that this guy is just an ordinary dude, and nobody bothers to get him back, and all you hear is sort of a tiff from the opposition. Like, that was unthinkable 10 years ago, 15 years ago. You can harken back to the days of Richard Nixon. I mean, if you look at what drove Richard Nixon to resign, it's like sort of an hour's work in Trump world. Like, it's just sort of chump change. A bunch of his campaign guys broke into an office and he paid some hush money to keep from talking about it. In Trump world, that'd be like Tuesday, you know?
Yeah.
So it's hard to know what's normal anymore. I think Canadians maybe aren't there yet, but I hope that we don't get to the point where appalling becomes so normalized. But getting back to the media thing, we are seeing, you know, outrageous behavior by people claiming to be journalists. Becoming normalized, and people living in a world where they only consume that kind of airport media, and then you see them interviewed in Canada, the States, and they come across as Manson girls or something, where they just
you just wonder, like, what planet they live on. But there's more and more and more of these folks now, and that is really troubling. And it doesn't bode very well at all. What we need to do is professionalize media.
Yeah.
Say, like, you're not in the media if you work for an organization whose only job, if you work for media who has other sort of things that they're doing other than actually gathering information and opinion and putting it out to the public. If you work for an organization that is in the advocacy game or the fundraising game, and you make yourself look like a journalist and you put out a product that looks like journalism, you should not be allowed to call yourself a journalist.
And that part of it, I mean, that doesn't change even if he loses the election and is dispatched from public life. I mean, that infrastructure will still be there, right?
Oh, yeah, and it's something that journalists need to fix. This is something that the media itself, which has struggled for years to professionalize, is going to have to really come to grips with this and set up standards and set up a way for people to know whether or not they're actually hearing from a real journalist or someone who's simply using their free expression rights to make a point for, say, a political movement or a political party, which is completely legitimate behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But just don't call yourself a journalist. I can't call myself a plumber because I have a wrench. And that, if I come to fix your pipe, God help you, really. But I could call myself a journalist, and anybody else can. You set up a blog, for a few bucks, and you're off to the races. I am now a journalist. I publish, OttawaWatch.com or some such thing, but also be paid by some sort of political organization that's really just an arm's length thing for a political party. I mean, that's just wrong. And if governments try to do anything about it, of course, the world would go crazy. It really has to be journalism coming together, without people sort of backsliding. And what happened when Stephen Harper was prime minister and he went after the press gallery was that the Post Media, well, they weren't called Post Media then, they weren't owned by the people who own it now, but the company that owned the Post Media papers quickly caved in, and you have to have solidarity to professionalize. And I've been a journalist, and I'm a lawyer now, and as a lawyer, I am governed by a professional body with a set of professional standards that mm-hmm. if I breach, I will get into serious trouble. And when I call myself a lawyer, I am a lawyer. And if anybody else calls themselves a lawyer who aren't governed by my law society, they're actually breaking the law. And the difference in my two lives is so profound because, as a journalist, really it's all sort of suggested or whatever, and it's, And again, there were so many people who called themselves journalists who were just simply not.
And so, as a former journalist, as a historian, and someone who's looked at Polyev's life as closely as you have, let's just say he gets elected in 10 days prime minister. What's that relationship going to be like between Canada and the United States? I mean, how do you think he'll handle Trump?
I just worry. I have this picture in my mind's eye of him going to Mar-a-Lago. I always call it Largo. It's Mar-a-Lago.
Mm-hmm.
And just getting completely weak in the knees, being among all those guys, Stephen Millers and all that, those creeps, who are like-minded people, and getting lost in that world. And I think that would be very, very bad. We need somebody who has some distance on it. I mean, all the political leaders have some relationship with the United States. If you look at their education or their business lives or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the fact that Polyev is so tune with the MAGA crowd is not a good thing for Canada, and I think it'd be very hard for him to separate like what they think they want for the world and what we need in Canada. I think you want to be their friend.
Yeah,
and you can only be Donald Trump's friend by kissing his ass. You know, there's no other way for him to appreciate you. You look around, look at those videos of his cabinet meetings where each cabinet member talks to him like the sycophants around Kim Il-jong talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow, that's what it takes. And if he sees that's what it takes, I'm afraid he'll do it.
Yeah. What's next for you? You're working on another book now?
Yeah, I want to do a book about media.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't really given that a lot of thought before, but I definitely want to take that part of the Polya book farther. I don't think it'll be nearly as popular with the world. I don't expect journalists to line up to buy it, and I don't expect the public to be all that interested, but I still think I should do it, and then I want to go back and write this really fun history that I've been dying to do for ages. It'd be a total palate cleanser to just bury myself among dead people and write about the crazy dead are really the people I prefer to write about. But I also think that we're in this revolution right now, this right-wing extremist authoritarian revolution, and I need to get some things at least on the record.
And see
what I can do to do my part in it, not to make it happen.
Well, I have to say, when the idea of your book hit my desk, I wasn't looking forward to it because I didn't find the guy interesting, and I found him distasteful. But I have to say, it's a highly readable book and fascinating chronicle of the past, say, 20, 25 years in this country that I can't recommend it enough. I appreciate your time today, Mark.
Well, thank you. When I was writing it, I was thinking, when I buy this book, I don't know. But, yes. Thanks for calling. Thanks for your interest.
The book is called Ripper, The Making of Pierre Polyev. It's published by Biblioasis. Its author, Mark Burry, joined me on the line from Ottawa. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunton.